I'm Dr. Nolte with Blind Politics, and this is a Blind Politics issue brief. We're trying a new content format here with American One, where I do some shorter content that is sort of quick, punchy, discussing issues that are maybe not getting discussed enough in the media, telling you what's going on, why it matters, and the long-term impact. Today, I want to start with something that's kind of in my wheelhouse as a foreign policy issue. You may or may not have been following what's happening in Ukraine very closely, but recently it became clear that Russia is receiving arms shipments from Iran in terms of their war in Ukraine. We saw some suicide drones, for example, that went off in the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv this weekend. Those drones appear to be of Iranian manufacture. Okay, so Russia is now getting its weapons and military hardware from Iran, and this is demonstrated by the fact that they're using it. Okay, so it's not just that Iran is promising arms sales. Russia is actually deploying Iranian-built systems in the war in Ukraine. It's very hard sometimes to figure out what's going on with Ukraine and Russia, and there's a lot of propaganda and counter-propaganda. The Russians are considered masters of sort of manipulating battlefield information, and the Ukrainians are certainly holding their own, if not more so, in that. So it's hard to cut through all the propaganda and figure out what's happening. But when you see deployment of a system that has Iranian roots in it, that is actually an Iranian system that's being deployed by the Russians, that tells us a couple of very significant things, and it has some interesting implications. The first of those implications is that Russian military equipment shortages are very real. Russia is, in fact, running out of equipment. Why? Because, generally speaking, when you look at arms deals between Russia and other countries, Russia's the seller, not the buyer. Russia has been selling equipment to Iran for a long time, and the same actually is true of many countries around the world. So if Russia is, in fact, now to the point where they are pulling equipment from a country that used to be and has traditionally been thought of by them as a client, both in the sense of a client that you're selling weapons to, or a client in the sense of a regime that is sort of dependent on your own, that really bodes. And that says that whatever Putin might say, Russia's ability to continue to produce and field these high-quality, at least perceived to be high-quality systems that they've had in the past, has taken it on the chin. Second is that, paradoxically, Russia's become more enmeshed in sort of an alliance system with Iran and China than it was before the war. It was one of the speculations that a lot of people had about, you know, Putin and his war aims in Ukraine. One of the speculations was that essentially the reason that Putin was doing this was so that he could increase Russia's sort of status in the world and gain more of a hegemonic position, at least in part, within Europe. But what it seems like the effect of this is that Russia has become more dependent on China, more dependent on Iran, and more of a sort of bit player in this coalition. Okay? So one outcome that is bad for everyone, but that seems increasingly likely at the end of this war. By bad for everyone, I mean it's not in the West's interest, it's not in Russia's interest, it's not in anybody's interest. But one increasingly likely outcome seems to be that China is going to have a preponderance of influence in Russia once the war is over, both in terms of its economic reach and in terms of, you know, sort of its control over actors who are key actors in the levers of power. It's hard to see Putin surviving a defeat. And it is likely, therefore, that whatever regime post-dates Putin is going to be much more beholden to China, right? And so Russia will be in China's sphere of influence. That is a shift. Previously, there was a partnership. Russia was a junior partner, to be sure, but they were a partner. I think Russia could come out of this war as more of a client than a partner. The third thing that this definitely indicates is that the Obama administration's, or I'm sorry, I always get those two things mixed up. But in this case, there's a specific reason why that makes sense, because in this particular issue, the Biden administration is essentially zombie Obama 2.0. So the Biden administration's policy toward Iran has been an abject failure. You now have a situation where even as the Biden administration is finally at long last tacitly acknowledging, based on their criticisms of the Iranian regime's suppression of the protests, that they are not going to get a nuclear deal. At the same time, their primary objective, okay, the Biden administration's primary objective in foreign policy right now is to bring an end to the war in Ukraine in such a way that leads to a Ukraine maintaining its territorial integrity on one hand and no nuclear escalation on the other, okay? Iran is directly aiding Russia in the war, which means that even as the Iranians are, you know, in theory at least, supposed to be negotiating this nuclear deal with the Biden administration, and they're at the same time undercutting and directly undercutting the Biden administration's own supposed aims. But on the other side of that, the Iran nuclear deal was always going to require the Biden administration to give Russia sanctions relief. Okay? So now you have a situation where there's a direct conflict. One of the interesting questions that this raises is there have been a couple of political figures in Israel who have speculated about helping the Ukrainians. This would be a significant shift on Israel's part. For those who have been listening to the audio podcast for a while, you may remember I did a very early in the war in Ukraine, I did a podcast looking at sort of the impact of the Ukraine-Russia war on the Middle East. And I said this really put Israel in a difficult spot because on the one hand, for many emotional reasons and practical reasons, they would have ties to Ukraine. You know, Zelensky is the sort of the first non-Israeli but Jewish head of state, currently in office, right? So there's emotional ties. And there have also been a lot of Ukrainian Jewish refugees that have come to Israel. And so groups like the Jewish Agency have been active with that. But on the other hand, it's been important for Israel for national security reasons to maintain a relationship with Russia so that they can do what's called deconfliction, which is making sure that Israel's proxies or groups that Israel's working with or operations that Israel's running don't run into the Russians in a significant way in areas where they're both operating. This is code for Syria, by the way, in case you were wondering. Okay, so that's been a thing. If Israel were to come out and sort of actively start sending weapons or even selling weapons to Ukraine, that would be a significant shift for them. However, there's a reason why it might make sense, and that reason is this. This gives the Israelis the best opportunity they've had in a long time to do a direct field test of some of the capabilities that the Iranians have. Okay? And when you look at sort of Israel's security posture right now, yes, having that deconfliction relationship with Russia is nice. It's a good thing to have in Syria. But Iran is the existential threat. And when it comes down to it, if Israel has to choose between maintaining good ties with Russia and gaining an advantage on Iran, which it sees as an existential threat, it's going to take the advantage on Iran every day, right? And so will there be significant pressure within Israel's political systems for Israel to take a more pro-Ukrainian stance, right? That's an issue that we should definitely be keeping an eye on. And if you start seeing the Israelis, either privately or publicly, offering some of their systems to the Ukrainians to counter those Iranian systems, there's some very good geostrategic reasons why they might do so. What's the long-term impact of this? Does it have any impact on Putin's nuclear calculation? No, it does not. That's a whole separate issue. We may do one of these issue briefs on Putin nuclear weapons and all that kind of stuff as well. I continue to be skeptical that he will ultimately decide that that's a road that he wants to go down. That doesn't mean that it's impossible, but I think it's a little bit more complicated for Putin to actually use a nuclear weapon than a lot of commentators would indicate. And I also think there's a pretty good shot that the U.S. can respond in a way that is non-nuclear, but that is extremely painful. That doesn't mean that the U.S. should publicly take a nuclear response off the table if Russia is going to use nukes, because we know that nuclear weapons deter the use of nuclear weapons, right? So the threat of you using nukes deters your neighbor from using nukes. We know this because it's been working since essentially the beginning of the Cold War. So you don't want to necessarily take it off the table. That being said, there are some non-nuclear responses the United States could engage in that wouldn't involve U.S. boots on the ground necessarily, but that would hurt the Russians real bad and significantly discourage anybody from doing this again. But I'm not convinced that Putin has you know, escalated to that point, and this issue with Iran doesn't necessarily change that. But what it does indicate is that the U.S. is not neutral when it comes to Russia and Ukraine. They should not be, and this should be a bipartisan issue, okay? the two countries that most Republicans would say are our chief adversaries are China and Iran. And if you're looking carefully at what's happening right now, at Russia buying weapons from China, at Russia buying weapons from Iran, it's pretty clear that China and Iran are on the side of the Russians right now. They are on the side of Putin. Okay? And just as a general principle of strategy, anything your opponent wants, you want them to not have. Okay? So it's reasonable for the United States, whatever we may think of, you know, some of the ideological stuff, it's reasonable for the United States to have a tilt toward Ukraine. Because realpolitik dictates that China and Iran are our chief adversaries in the region of the Middle East for Iran and globally for China. And they are invested, to one degree or another, in a Russian military success here. Okay, so to a certain extent, it is worth the United States investing in Russian defeat and Ukrainian victory. To what extent, your mileage may vary. Certainly, I would say we're not to the point of U.S. boots on the ground. We're not to the point of directly committing U.S. troops to combat against the Russians. We're not even close to that point. But certainly to the point of continued robust bipartisan support for what we're already doing, and a plan to escalate what we're already doing to a whole another level if Russia ends up using tactical nuclear weapons. In the meantime, the Ukrainian war is giving us an opportunity from, again, a very cold-blooded, realist perspective to see the capabilities that one of our chief geopolitical adversaries might have. Okay? This is giving us a live test of Iranian systems and capabilities in some areas that are very important tactically, both for the United States and for Israel. Okay? I can't say that this is a good thing, but every cloud has a silver lining, and the silver lining here is this is forcing the Iranians to show their hands and to show us what they've got. And so we can learn from that. All right, that's going to be it for this issue brief. Hope it's been informative, enlightening, and interesting. And so for Blind Politics, this is Dr. Nolte signing off.